Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And as always, the trusty sidekick, I'm Tom Costura.
And in this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump in to the top threat hunting headlines for September 1st, 2025. Tom, how do you want to kick this off? What do you got for us this week?
So I think I'm going to start with an article from Microsoft Security. So this one's titled Storm 0501's Evolving Techniques Leads to Cloud-Based Ransomware. So general summary we're looking at here, Storm 0501, which is a financially motivated threat actor, has shifted from their traditional on-premises ransomware tactics to highly destructive cloud-based ransom operations. And instead of deploying malware on endpoints, the group now exploits hybrid cloud environments, compromising Active Directory, Entra Connect sync servers, and leveraging other various weak configurations to kind of gain full control over that cloud identity and data infrastructure. And then from there, they will rapidly exfiltrate data, delete backups and resources, demand ransom, and all the spicy things that you would see from a ransomware attack. So some of the kind of technical details inside of this one. So the compromise of that hybrid infrastructure, Storm 0501 exploits the trust gaps across the fragmented 80 domains and Azure tenants, and pivoting from on-premise Active Directory to Microsoft Entra ID via compromised Entra Connect sync servers. And they'll use a tool called EvilWinRM, as well as some built-in commands or built-in tool sets. We're talking like QUser, .exe, net.exe, et cetera, to kind of move laterally and identify the gaps, specifically targeting areas not protected by Defender or Endpoint. We see an excessive amount, or they perform the DC sync attacks to extract those credential hashes by simulating a domain controller. And then using the directory sync account, Storm 0501 runs Azure Hound to identify global admin identities that have no MFA, resets credentials via sync, and then registers MFA under their own control to kind of bypass that conditional access. So the persistent identity backdoor, after gaining global admin privileges, the threat actor configures a malicious federated domain using SAML token attacks to impersonate any user within the tenant. And then they elevate themselves to owner across all Azure subscriptions, basically enabling that full control. And then Once this is done, Storm 0501 will map the Azure environment to locate critical data stores, and they expose additional Azure storage accounts, and then they'll steal the access keys and move data out via AZ copy CLI. They also delete the storage accounts, the backups, the resource locks, and the immutable policies. And then for protected storage objects, they'll create a key vault with a custom key using the Azure encryption scopes, basically to allow them to mass encrypt. And then the nice little cherry on top from here is, after they kind of go through this destruction path, the actor will deliver a nice little ransom demand using Microsoft Teams, sending from those compromised admin accounts, which is kind of funny. But really, there are some interesting pivot points to this one, Scott. I did find it interesting when I read through this article. There was that typical Storm 0501 on-premise kind of get in, look to laterally move, see what they can leverage. But in this case, what they were doing was they were laterally moving and pivoting across different points until they found the thing they needed to go after, the goal they wanted, which was the cloud infrastructure. And in this case, they actually found a system level account that had not had any type of multi-factor assigned to it and was easily abused. So they took over that account, reset it, reallocated, set up MFA. And that was the kind of key that let them get in to kind of do a lot of this destruction. So it was like that small little wrinkle inside of a cloud deployment. And I know we've talked about stuff with cloud before. This one always sticks in my mind, because when I think about that cloud security side, I always think about, like, how do we pump the brakes on speed to market? And this seems like this is kind of one of those things that was just potentially missed in this specific attack, where they were deploying and forgot about this one little crack. And surprise, surprise, the bad actor had found it. But, we're continuing to talk more and more about cloud attacks. So I thought this one was interesting to bring up. Definitely some meat inside of there, but you know, I'll stop and see if you had any thoughts on your scan over this one.
Yeah, so a couple of things. I think it's interesting that, you know, we've always talked about cloud attacks, and it's usually some sort of credential driven attack. Like, it's once it's about getting access, and then once you have access, and ironically, it seems like there's not a lot of elevation that happens with a lot of the things I've seen. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the stuff that usually gets publicized, it seems like the access that they stumble on or adversaries get has the appropriate amount of access they need to do a lot more in the cloud than they probably should. But you know, I remember even working with Microsoft when we were trying to go to the cloud, you know, probably, gosh, almost a decade ago. And then it was interesting how the conversation around security was more like firewalls are dead because things are going zero trust, which means it's more about credentials or authentication. That's where security lies. And, you know, if you look at kind of how cloud is managed, that might be why they kind of have that perspective where it's a lot of it has to do with if are you authorized and are you able to authenticate and how. So it's kind of like, you know, highlighted that for me, or that conversation kind of brought it to the forefront again. The other thing I noticed, which is interesting, is one of some of the discovery things they're doing on-premise was the SC query, which is basically checking the state of services. And this was more looking to see if like Windows Defender or any of the antivirus type stuff that was there, was the service was running. So they kind of had the sense of that. It's not uncommon, but in a lot of discovery stuff that we typically see run the mill, SC isn't used as commonly. And so I think that would stand out. And another thing that's nice about SC is I would not imagine, you know, a lot of the discovery commands are shared by administrators. I would imagine that, a lot of administrators don't use SC in their typical day-to-day discovery job. So looking for that might actually maybe turn up less false positives. So something that kind of to note there. There's one other thing that I also thought about that I thought was an interesting find, and now it might be escaping me.
So there's one that I'm curious what you think. So they're the one that I kind of put down, because I always kind of weigh this idea, and most of it's just from experience on trying to successfully like put this in place in a way that was meaningful and didn't generate crazy false positives. But in the part of them pivoting to the cloud here, there is one thing that I wonder where we could apply it for the idea for either a detection hunt type of thought process. They seem that the threat actor actually attempted to sign into different several privileged user accounts to try to leverage the credentials they might have had, but were in most cases thwarted by MFA. Right. And you see that kind of repetition of that, you know, there's my mind's always looking for ways to chain that as a way to identify this kind of activity. And I think this particularly for cloud, because like you said when we started, it almost always is almost always it's a credential access type of thing, right? That's how they're getting in the gate. And yeah, that one stood out to me. It's like, yeah, no, this would be something to definitely look for. If I remember correctly, I think there's like things that sit there inside of Microsoft's environment that will, like the basic security stuff, that might give you some indication of that if you kind of, you know,
if
you're around or leverage it.
If your policy requires MFA and someone's trying to log in multiple times and failing, and that's going to be, it will alert you like, you know, fail because MFA is not enabled, whatever. Right. I think that behavior, and then especially if you combine that where now they registered for MFA. Now, granted, if you're just now rolling out MFA or, getting all that stuff set up, I'm sure that'd be really hard to like look for that behavior because people are like failing it. But like, if it's a standard practice, most people had MFA set up before they even attempt it, right? So it's worth noting, especially when you even look at those, you can see the type of account being used. And if it's not, you get used to how your accounts are supposed to look, and it sounds like they found like an older kind of system based account. That in itself might stand out as unique.
I was thinking that too. Like, you have an account that you know, it might be an original deploy account or an old school admin account that you use to stand it up. And then you suddenly see that it's been rolled in the MFA. Maybe there's some comparison thing you can do there with, you know, date account activated versus enrolled in MFA, to kind of use that as an anomalous detection or trigger to look at something more.
Yeah, and the other thing too was the for the persistence piece, adding a domain that'd be federated, right? So what federated really means is you trust another domain, another group, entity or whatever that has their own set of accounts. And because you already have that trust with that entity, those accounts are now allowed to be leveraged in your environment. I loosely want to say, if I don't think it's the same thing, but similar to the experience of, you know, you use your Google account or your Facebook account to log into things, you're kind of like being federated because you have an account with them and they're allowing you to sign into things. But that's the kind of idea. And to be able to add that trust, I imagine there's telemetry there too. And that's not a normal thing to just add federated services or entities to your environment. Definitely worth looking for. And then using the Azure CLI to move data, right? I'm sure there's backups and things, but it's good to know how that, if it's being leveraged to move data internally in your environment or to like traditional processes, it's good to know how that's being leveraged, because that is a common technique of how people have exfil data out of Azure, especially moving it to like an adversary Azure instance to like move data over fast. But I'm pretty sure some of the data in there is probably consistent enough for you to say, oh, this is what we normally do, and now this one's really out of the ordinary, and you can kind of build that list of what's normal to help you with that. That was another thing that I thought is worth paying attention to, because it's a common, I think I've seen it numerous times in Azure environments, how data has gotten moved out.
A good point. What do you got next?
Yeah, I'm going to jump into a checkpoint post, and this one is called, I can see the title here, Zipline Campaign. It's a sophisticated phishing attack targeting U.S. companies. This was interesting because, one, it's not like your traditional phishing that you would typically see. It looks like the attackers were actually leveraging the company's website specifically through like their third-party like contact us forms, is what they called out. You know, basically, you know, you can go to someone's website, and then if you want to reach out to them, instead of emailing them directly, you can kind of use their contact us form, put in your information, put in your little note, and then if they have processes, they may reach out, may not, but kind of waiting for you to reach back out to them. And, you know, what's interesting about this, it kind of adds kind of a legitimacy to you. And then they said there, I think they're also using domains that kind of match names of LLCs that are registered, so that you could, if you were to look up even the domain, you'd be like, oh, it's a real company potentially. They had that kind of interesting legitimate approach, and then they didn't really send anything malicious until they kind of built more rapport. So they said in some instances, there was like a couple of weeks of just back and forth communication, and they were talking about how they had like these services they can offer sometimes around AI stuff to help with that. And then they would send a zip that would contain an LNK. And so the interesting thing about this specific zip archive that they send across is it does have the LNK like we've seen before, where it has PowerShell as part of the target file command, so that it's running something in PowerShell. But what's interesting is that PowerShell isn't really the full payload. So they've actually embedded more PowerShell in the zip archive at the binary level. And the PowerShell command in the LNK file was written so that it can extract the other PowerShell to then run what was embedded, which is really fascinating, because it's another way to kind of obfuscate what you're actually trying to run, because people do look for some key things. That being said, you're still going to have that chaining event, right? We always talk about, or I talk about a lot too, like that script interpreter chaining, where you got PowerShell then executing PowerShell. And PowerShell chaining is interesting because it's not as common if it's legitimate type stuff. So that's one thing that was interesting. But the other things I thought were also interesting was, I thought it was just good information for people to have. When the LNK file executes the PowerShell command, it does a bunch of coordinated actions, you know, it locates the zip file specifically, right? Because it's got to extract that additional PowerShell, and it looks for several common folders, it says, where the zip could be located. And I think this is good because it gives you an idea of where files will drop that users potentially use, or that malware, when it gets dropped, potentially gets used. So they're good directories to keep in mind and potentially build types of content around, like, are, do you have zip files, executables, script files being dropped in locations? Some of them could be more false positive than not, but they, you know, the things they specifically look for was either the desktop, the downloads folder, documents, temp, program data, which we've all seen on variations of those in previous attacks, but then also parent of the current working directory, which meaning, like, you know, where the things are being executed from, which is, I'm surprised that's not even first. I don't know if they listed in order which they search, but that's how that works. Then the other thing, so it, it, you know, it pulls out, extracts that, copies a zip archive to the program data folder. That's where it extracts things there, opens up, you know, the fake file to make it look legitimate. Then the other thing it does, and it looks like this is done in PowerShell, and one of it's an AMSI, AMC bypass. That's basically like a defense, a scripting defense, built in to Windows to help, prevent malicious scripts from running. And it actually is calling the system management automation AMSI utils AMSI init failed parameter, and it says equals true, basically saying AMSI fail, which basically tricks AMSI into thinking it failed to initialize, so then it doesn't do the checks it's supposed to do, which I thought was an interesting thing to kind of look for as just a bypass. And then the other things it does that are kind of savvy, and we've talked about some of these before, is the use of COM objects. So in the registry, COM objects are ways to, like, leverage different components of other executables or libraries potentially. And they use CLS IDs, which looks like a GUID, right, in the registry path. And in this case, there's an identifier tied to Microsoft web browser components. And there's a script that assigns to that CLS ID that points to a file that they named update underscore srv.sct. The SCT file, it's created by that PowerShell script, but what it does, it populates a malicious XML scriptlet. So the scriptlet in there, the content was originally base64 encoded, is decoded, written to the disk with the script moniker, so that it knows to execute a script when that COM object is basically invoked. And so that means anything, obviously, with Internet Explorer, right, will launch it. But it's also tied, some of those components are tied to explorer.exe. So just your Windows Explorer, which is going to be every time you pretty much open up Windows, Windows Explorer is going to load, it triggers it. So that's an interesting persistent mechanism. But what to note there is that scriptlet, it contains JavaScript code. So that would mean it's probably going to be executed with WScript when it runs. And then WScript's going to call CMD with the silent switch, which is a slash K. So now you have, once again, script interpreting, calling, you know, chaining, which you have WScript executing CMD, and probably with interesting arguments, right, to pay attention to. So another thing to, like, pay attention to with some of the just basic behaviors that, you know, are easily identifiable, even though this is a, you know, fairly crafty attack. One of the things it does that I thought was interesting was it located the Windows API functions, but it didn't do so by using their names. It actually was basically dynamically finding the addresses of those API functions and storing those instead, which I thought was an interesting way to try to be less obvious for anything that monitors API calls that way. It had some ANSI debugging stuff. So obviously it searched for specific debugging tools, kind of a list there. Look for named pipes that are associated and virtualization type keys. And then they look for some system specific stuff, you know, typical anti-sandboxing methodologies there. And then the victim identification, they do the CRC32 hash of the product ID as the victim ID. This is interesting just because if you are doing, like, a sandboxing environment, obviously that's going to be the same every single time. From the same types of instances or boxes. So you kind of get familiar with, oh yeah, this is a sandbox, don't do anything with this one. So those are some interesting things. And the other thing it does leverage, which you kind of see this on and off, I think. But it's use of DNS tunneling. In this case, they're using the TXT or the text record. And there's a, like what, I think a 60 character limit or something like that when it comes to some of the subdomain or domain, or it, I think it's the limit it sets on itself, actually, if I remember, it's like hard-coded. But that limit is good to know, because the smaller that is, the more requests have to go out to like do full commands and, you know, get output from commands and all those types of things. So you should see a kind of a surge of DNS queries to a said subdomain or multiple subdomains to the same domain. And that kind of stands out. But if that fails, it does fall back to HTTP. The only thing to really note there is it still uses the same kind of encryption mechanism that it does to encrypt the payloads in the DNS tunneling, but it does it with HTTP. So if you see HTTP and the payload and traffic looks encrypted, it's interesting to see encrypted traffic in HTTP when it's not HTTPS and it can just be encrypted that way. So that's one of the things it does for the C2 elements there. But those are, yeah, some of the really interesting, I guess, artifacts and behaviors about this kind of campaign that I thought were interesting. I don't know what you thought when you kind of put eyes on this.
You kind of stabbed all the threat hunting side. I guess there's one thing that did stand out to me aside from that a little bit. The where they discussed the social engineering, the phases into that, to where they would issue through the contact form. And then they would, in some cases, actually engage with somebody through multiple communication layers. So they would go through multiple emails and such to kind of almost build that trust before sending that malicious zip archive over to them. So that's something we've talked about a little bit in quite a few of our episodes this year about those like more approaches to trusting. And I that stood out to me, aside from every, you know, I don't want to double through everything you had said already about some of the technical hunting pieces, but that was interesting to me. And I wonder if we're, you know, paying attention to that kind of ebb and flow between all the things we see with like the you know, the IT worker hire resume processes that we've seen a lot, you know, the leveraging of, you know, fake Zoom calls, the engagement with emails, and this one to kind of like build these layers of trust to basically get more embedded with somebody to get something connected. But I thought it was a very unique path for this one specifically to leverage, because we've seen stuff before. I think we've seen stuff personally before where that contact form was trying to be leveraged on a website for some kind of a malicious something. But to the fact where they would go multiple layers deep of communicating with someone to build that trust and then deploy the payload, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you got to wonder, because, you know, we always joked in the past, like if you just sent an email that said, click me, you would still get people to click, right? And and then you got these other attacks you see where they're very involved to develop that trust to make sure things happen, right? And you got to wonder, is it just the laziness and the different approach of different attackers, or is like security awareness training effective enough that they have to now put a little more effort into this to make it as successful as they need it to be to make it worth their time? You know, you just kind of wonder, you know, why
and some of the other reasons.
Yeah, like why the effort when if you're looking just for numbers, you could get clicks, right? That's not the hard part, but maybe if your targets are like, you need this target because you have value assigned to it or something. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. Or a good point.
So what do you got for us next?
All right, pivoting over to my second one for this week. So I have an article from Groove IB. It's titled Shadow Silk, a cross-border binary union for data exfiltration. I'm going to word properly before the show's over, I promise. So Shadow Silk is an APT group that's been active since 2023, and it's still operating as recently as July of this year. They primarily focused on targeting government organizations for data exfil. Group IB's research has identified more than 35 victims, mostly in the Central Asia government sector, the APAC area. The group appears to have ties to the Eurotrooper threat actor, leveraging infrastructure and tools previously attributed to them. So Shadow Silk consists of two subgroups with both Chinese and Russian-speaking operators, though the extent of their cooperation is still unclear. based on the reporting. Their toolkit is diverse, combining public exploits, penetration testing, utilities, dark web source, web panels to manage those compromised devices, and more. Notably, though, a portion of stolen data believed to belong to Shadow Silk surfaced for sale on dark web forums, making that kind of the first time that this data has appeared publicly. So kind of walking into some of the technical details that we see here for this specific report, again, that initial access side is primarily leveraged from public-facing applications and vulnerabilities and the use of those public exploits against them, as well as some phishing campaign approaches for that initial access. And when we looking down in all of the different things that happened during execution, so there's a heavy reliance on PowerShell tooling, which really shows a shift from their previous leveraging of like Python rats to moving over to more of a PowerShell based rat and more. We see common things throughout a lot of this. Well, common relative to what we talk about, Scott, but you got your invoke web request commands using PowerShell to pull down payloads. You also see curl being leveraged to do the same thing. You see the typical registry edits to establish that persistence in that current version run key. You see the swath of discovery commands being used to help enumerate. So your IP configs, your whoami, system info, things like that. We also see a wdigest authentication settings that are manipulated to kind of allow the credentials to store in memory in plain text. So that wdigest downgrade attack, we might have talked about it a couple of times. I know me and you are both familiar with it. Then you also see the heavy use of Cobalt Strike, Metasploit, Meterpreter, other tooling like that. So relative to C2, a couple bullets here. An infected host managed via web panels that are purchased on the dark web forum. So this is something that's allowing this to be seen more up front. And the web panels kind of provide that centralized control over, you know, multiple compromised systems or targets. And then what we see some of the data exfil side, it really seems to be focused on sensitive government data from that APAC area. And they leverage obfuscated PS code that would then initiate a search for specific file extensions across all the drives. And there are parameters based on what they're going for. Zip them up, upload them to C2 server, followed by the deletion of that archive to cover its tracks. And then they would surface on that dark web to kind of, you know, push out that. And like I had mentioned already, there's been one reference to this already being listed as public. So I'm assuming we're going to see more of that. All in all, though, Scott, there's nothing overwhelmingly new here. There were a couple different combinations of the common attacks we talked about. Usually when we see some of those, I don't necessarily see that wdigest downgrade attack. So that was kind of new relative to the combo of things that occur here. But it was a well-written article, very clean references. You can really see the activity, break it out really well from a hunter side or hunter mindset. You know, the other part I thought was interesting is that combination of Russian and Chinese actor overlap. That's something that should concern everybody because there's a lot of skill set there, especially when we talk about the nation state backed groups specifically. But yeah, you know, ultimately, I thought it was just a good overall article that really touched on a lot of things, showed a lot of detail for leveraging it to operationalize it in your environment. But what did you think, Scott?
Yeah, no, I thought it was a great article to kind of get the attacker's perspective because they have like a lot of good screenshots of like the specific tools that they use and what it might look like from their perspective. And then they do, I mean, because there's obviously more adversaries or so it's not just adversaries, but people involved in this. You can see a lot of, you know, we talk about behaviors and people are familiar with MITRE and it's like downloading tools. Well, there's multiple ways tools are downloaded mentioned in this. From using curl to using PowerShell to whatever. So I think it's a great example of, hey, when you want to cover down on, you know, a MITRE technique, or tactic, it's really good to see these types of things to say like, gosh, how many things map to the same thing, but they're all things I should be looking for. So I think it calls that out. The other thing it caught me because I don't see it that much, but we're all familiar in PowerShell, right? When you want to download something, it's very common to do the invoke web request. We talk about it. A lot of attackers use it when they want to, and then they, you know, you provide a URL and so forth. And I know in some of the things I talk about when I've done like webinars or talks, and I give an example of like hunting for PowerShell, right? Just showing like the numbers, data, and how you can change how you think and how you query to get good results just on something as general as that. And I do talk about like there's multiple ways to download things via PowerShell. It's not just invoke web requests. I have the same problem you have too. And in one of the script blocks they show is they're using the invoke REST method, which is also a way to download things via PowerShell. It's not as used as commonly, and I think I've seen it before, but if not, I know when I did the research on just looking for how do you download things with PowerShell, you know, when I built a hunt on just that, I made sure to include the invoke REST method, to include the invoke web request, the net.client. Whatever it was, or the net client way where you can just call the object specifically in a single hunt looking for that type of behavior via PowerShell because it can change up on you, right? And the other thing I was thinking is now are they using and looking at the structure of some of this code, is this because they have different people, or is that how like ChatGPT would tell you how to download something with PowerShell? And so they get something different than what most people are typically use. Kind of curious about that too, because we know that happens more and more. And if you look throughout this too, like we called it out in some of the last articles and things we discussed, there's a lot of PowerShell calling CMD and CMD calling PowerShell, kind of that script interpret language executing chains. We see it everywhere. It's definitely worth figuring out how to look for the tool sets you have and what that looks like in your environment. But those are two major things I would say that I thought were very interesting looking at this. But as far as an article goes, this is a great view into a number of different ways attackers leverage their tools and really does organize their deliveries and methods. So,
yeah, there's also one too I failed to point out when I was walking through it. I want to make sure I speak on it correctly because it got lost on my notes here. So something that I've kind of had my hands on a little bit, and I'm not sure if we've talked about this before, but there, you know, we've discussed a lot of like browser stealers before in the past, and you know, those kinds of activities being in place. This was also mentioned inside of this attack chain, and there is one thing that people, when you're thinking about from the hunter side, that you can kind of look at. So as an example, the leveraging and stealing things like items from your past, like let's talk about, I'll use Chrome because that's what they reference here, but you're looking at like the password storage files along with like the decryption key for those exist inside of your system in that app data local Google Chrome user data local state directory. And when you see, you could look for anything touching that directory, adding, removing, pulling, copying, etc., because that typically doesn't happen. That's activity that's not typically standard, and that's specifically talking about just Chrome. I'm trying to find my notes here on the fly, on the quick, to look at some of the other areas that we see. So in some of the other browsers, you can see things that you might identify, for example, with Mozilla. So under the Mozilla Firefox profiles area, so some of those kinds of files being touched, you know, your key for dot database files being touched. There's a few different things there when you're looking at that kind of credential store access from a browser side that I thought was, it was a sub note. It's kind of quickly hidden in this article because there was so much meat to it, but I wanted to make sure I pulled that out and mentioned it too.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, what do you got last for us today?
All right. So last one's kind of interesting. It's from, I always butcher names that aren't really familiar to me, but the Secrete Lab or Secrete. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. But basically they have a blog and it's called Operation Hankook Phantom. It's a North Korean APT-37 targeting South Korea. And this one has some interesting technical details in it. The Secrete Lab uncovered a campaign where the threat actors are actually leveraging a National Intelligence Research Society letter as a decoy document right? It's something that I guess they'd assume people would want to check out. And so it made it look like a PDF, but it was really an LNK file, right? So we're seeing a lot of that, you know, you're passing LNK files in. It did hit a bunch of targeted countries within that region. You know, it wasn't just South Korea, but Japan, Vietnam, Russia, Nepal, China, India, Romania. So, you know, that whole kind of area in general had seen this type of activity. And just like on the previous ones, right, you have the LNK file, and it has PowerShell as part of the target file for the execution script built in. But what was interesting about this is two things. It had embedded data in the LNK file that the PowerShell would then carve out. That the last one we saw, it was part of the archive, right? So the PowerShell was binary data, part of the archive that it pulled out of the zip itself. This one, it was actually pulling out of the zip. So they are able to append data to the LNK, and then they carve it. So you see now two different campaigns where they're trying to use PowerShell to carve out data from what would be a normal benign file anyways for hiding their data. So that might be kind of a newer technique that people are leveraging. So it's good to pay attention to, well, how do you use PowerShell to extract these things? And these articles, they kind of touch on it. Some of them's kind of hard to see. I had to rely on screenshots, but in this one, I really wanted to see it, and they're very blurry. But not only that, it also carved out some bat files, right? So, you know, those are like batch files that usually CMD will run. So as well, you'll also see where PowerShell's going to also kick off CMD with execution there. So you have that script interpreter chaining. I need to come up with a better name for that because I have a hard time saying it all the time. But so you kind of have that behavior. They have a good screenshot of showing it too. It other than the fact it's very blurred out, so you can't see all the commands because they had Procmon running. And you can see where CMD is actually then running PowerShell, which is then runs CMD, which then runs PowerShell. So, you know, just seeing a bunch of that, it's very questionable. But they have some commands, and I want to run this through something to clean it up to actually pull out some of those key things I was talking about. Like, what's their method for carving things out using PowerShell? Because those, I think, are the really good fingerprints to be looking for. One, to, if this is a newer technique, be able to identify that. But two, it really lets you know if you find something, you know, is it related to this or something new? So they have some examples of how that's being pulled out in some screenshots, and you can roughly make out some of the data. They're dropping what someone said they carve out in the local temp directory and the app data for the user. And so they walk through some of those things, and it does drop the rock rat malware, right? And just like most rats, a lot of the same type of capabilities, anti-VM type stuff, screenshots, you know, allows access, run shell code, kind of thing. The good thing to note is the shell code, when it's retrieved or executed, the execution status is success or failed, and it's logged to a file. And the good news about this, it's a file that's a single character named text file. So once again, some lazy coding, Eureka. But either way, what's that?
Eureka.
I know, right? It's back. So with some single character created files, right? This one's a text file. So it's nothing executable, but it's something that's, it's just, you know, weird and worth looking at, especially depending on where that file exists. So something to kind of pay attention to there. When it does run things, it does run things under CMD. So with when the rat runs things, you can see where there's going to be some execution that's going to be constantly calling CMD for different commands. And so multiple instances of that CMD won't be the same one, right? Because CMD will run and exit, and then it'll issue another command, CMD will run, exit. So you should see kind of that pattern or what that would look like from an execution standpoint. So worth paying attention to. And it looks like they use a lot of different providers for C2. Uses Dropbox, pCloud, Yandex Disk for basically hosting things and hosting commands and things for their C2 in the cloud. But those are some of the major highlights I wanted to call out. And I think there's a lot of meat in this one. I think the challenging part is They do provide screenshots, which I usually love. It's just they're not crisp. So being able to like really stare at it hard, or maybe is there something that can help you clean it up, it'd be worth it as far as looking into it. But yeah, Tom, what was your thoughts and looking at some of this stuff that they provided here?
Mine, for me, there was a couple like obvious things where they were leveraging that temp directory for writes. The first one that stood out was that kind of abnormal, you know, where the initial payload, the fake PDF and the EXE, you know, there would be some random characters, alphanumeric characters, .bat files or .bat files. And then you'd see this one where it was like B plus LA plus T, you know, you see that kind of obscure extension inside of temp. That should be a good indicator for, hey, let's check this out and see what
worth looking
what's
at
going on there. The other one too, and you touched on this, so just was looking at it from a different point, is that where there was the command to run, it was like dir-a-s, I believe, if I remember right, where they were running kind of a recursive check for all files and then copying them into a .txt file inside of that temp folder. And this is where I think you pointed out the single character, another single character file thing. So those were the two that stood out to me. They seemed like pretty low hanging fruit to look at anomalous activity. You know, it's like, hey, these things should stand out by and large.
Yeah.
But there is a ton in this one. There is a ton in this one. And
it's just hard to pull out because of how it was written. But still, like I said, I think worth trying, especially if you're interested in some of those newer techniques we're describing.
Yeah, a lot of meat to this article. So definitely give it a check.
So with that, I just got a couple things to mention to pay attention to before we close out. One, our live podcast will be next week, September 11th. That uses noon to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. And it's another talk on AI, right? More AI. We had one, our last live was about, you know, AI, but we kind of had some threat hunting vibes there. This one is about scaling impact without losing control. Just some of our thoughts, some of the things we've read and seen to consider. A lot of people had liked our last conversation, and we just want to make sure we close it out to cover as much as we can before we move on to a net new topic to dig into. So we kind of have another one there. And then there is a threat hunting workshop, which is, you know, this is hunting for persistence. These are really good, especially if you're new to threat hunting or curious if you threat hunt similar to how we threat hunt, because we walk through live data using real behaviors and looking for the things that we typically would hunt for that you can kind of side by side, right? You can get access to the data to be able to hunt as well. You can then hunt afterwards. You'll kind of get the, you know, color by number for threat hunting a little bit for persistence. But this is a level 2. So there's a level 1. If you haven't done that, you can look for it through our websites to try to, you know, basically sign up to just get the access and see the videos to do it. But there's a level 2. So it's a little more advanced persistent type stuff we're looking at there. And with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 1st, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.